Triple M Rocks Sunday Arvo Footy. Triple M Rocks the Footy. For Harvey Norman Home Appliances. In 2016, you'll hear more footy than ever before across the Triple M NRL network.
Hey, this is Matty Johns.
Gordon Tullis.
Andrew Johns.
Ryan Girdler.
Wendell Saylor.
Paul Gallen.
MG.
And I'm Peter Sterling.
Let's listen. Yeah.
This is Sunday Triple M NRL with Paul Kent, Gordon Tullis, Ryan Girdler and Anthony Maroon for Brighton's Lawyers, protecting your future. Triple M rocks the footy. Triple M rocks the footy.
And a very good afternoon right across the Triple M network. We rock the NRL finals in fine style, haven't we? Had some good games. The number is 133353, broadcasting live today from Triple M headquarters, NRL headquarters in the Triple M Tower in Sydney. Maroon, Ryan Girdler, Paul Kent, and across the great Gordon Tullis. As usual, it's thanks to Brighton's Lawyers, protecting your future. Now, boys, we're going to kick off by talking about two great games that we've had over the weekend. And Friday night, the Cowboys 26-20 over the Broncos. Just an absolutely amazing game to watch. So many cracking good tries and line breaks and all the things that make the game so wonderful to watch. And what have I just heard? The last four times these teams have met, 9 points separate them. They are real, real rivals in Queensland. And it's just become a... It's part of folklore to sit down and watch an NRL game between the Broncos and the Cowboys. Gordy, tell us, mate, what did you think?
Oh, it was absolutely outstanding. You don't think that they're going to do it. And obviously the Cowboys were the little brother for a long, long time, but they're the big brother now. So they both walk down the back stairs and go have a game in the backyard. And, you know, it just comes down to brilliance. Like, they know each other's game so well. They're always up for it. You throw the form out the window. Brisbane were absolutely outstanding, had the game won, it seems, but you've never got it won against the Cowboys and Jonathan Thurston's side. You know, he slots that goal, which he does it with so much ease, and then Temalolo was brewing, started charging through it. One thing I think the NRL did get it right was the change of the laws. Instead of having golden point, have like the 10-minute break, because it'd become a try. You know, like, then the game didn't get scrappy, they weren't offside, they weren't just trying for miracle field goals, and I thought the game was absolutely brilliant. What I liked, the fatigue come into it. There was blokes not turning up on their assignment. It's one of those games that I think that that would just go down in folklore. It probably wasn't as classy as some of the others, but I think there was more effort put into that game.
Ryan Girdler, good morning to you as well.
Yeah, and good morning,
boys. To
you,
Paul Kent. I'm sorry I didn't say good day, fellas.
You told us when we walked in that you didn't know how you were going to perform today, and you haven't started well, but that's okay. You can improve.
Certainly can. I've knocked off straight off the kickoff, Ryan, but what about that game on Friday night?
Look, I think you know, the reason we see such good contests between the two sides is they play a similar style. There's not a lot of wrestling in their games. They don't concentrate on the ruck or controlling of the ruck. They actually just concentrate on playing some footy, and I think that's why it's so refreshing, and we see the expansive style. Sure, there's errors, but there's always a lot of room around the rucks with those two sides because of that, because they get quick play the balls, and that's why I think you see some of the fittest guys in our game struggle, as Gordy said, to turn up for their assignment, because it's just helter-skelter. And yeah, look, I really enjoyed it. It wasn't, it probably wasn't as good as some of the other contests that we've seen between those two sides in the past, but it was certainly climactic, and certainly got the finish that we were all hoping for, and felt sorry for the Broncos. I thought they were brave, and certainly thought they were going to win there right up until the death. But, you know, fatigue and decision-making becomes... fatigue affects your decision-making, and we saw that with the Gillette. You know, we hung out a leg at the back, but he was exhausted, and, you know, it probably wasn't the right thing to do at the time, but it's hard to, you know, hold into account, because... At that point, it was just do whatever you can to you know, get your body in front of the Cowboys who were attacking the line. So, got to respect the Cowboys, though. They started really poorly, and I thought Jonathan Thurston was injured, but he was actually down with an illness through the week. And the true champion he was certainly there to put the polish on at the end. Probably didn't get as much footy as we're used to seeing him. Usually gets the ball three or four times every set of six, but he stood back and let Coote and Morgan and Granville and Tomalolo sort of dictate terms. And then when the play was there to be made, well, the great man stood up and made it.
I thought they actually, it was a perfect storm last night. They went at each other so quickly early in the match that they really just burned all the fuel. But by the end of the match, they're playing on instinct, and they're going back. You know, for all us people, you know, older than 25, it goes back to that era where blokes just had to drag themselves up and really didn't have the miles in the legs to get through 80 minutes at top speed all the time. And so that, to me, that adds to the contest. That's why I'm an advocate for bringing down the interchange, because when it gets to that stage where two teams are just tearing themselves apart and they're just getting up off the ground and trying to find extra efforts, that's when I believe the game's at its greatest. It's just, it was such a magic game last night. It wasn't a perfect game and there was mistakes in that. But the way who was in the lead swapped around, the fact that they were that far, like, you know, we saw Cowboys in front, then it was the Broncos, and then ultimately we go into extra time and they get up on top, then the Cowboys. I just thought it was a great game of rugby league, and that's, those sorts of games are why we love the game.
All right. Well, boys, we will ask you in the course of today, can the Cowboys make it back-to-back for the first time since 1992, 1993? But a big win for the Cowboys, 26 to Broncos, 20. They played last year's grand final, and the Cowboys are one more game away from playing in the grand final again this year. We're going to talk about the other game, the Raiders and the Panthers, very shortly, right here on Sunday Triple M NRL, thanks to Brighton's. No footy today, obviously, because we've had the two finals games. The next one, of course, was another cracking good one. Raiders 22, Panthers 12. The Viking clap. And just absolutely brilliant.
Officially the best crowd in the game at the moment.
21,500 of them too there, Gordy, and obviously a majority of them were Raiders supporters. But some Panthers supporters did make the trek to the nation's capital. Raiders 22, Panthers 12. They really didn't never look like losing that game and shot out to 18-0 before the Panthers struck back. But I know you're obviously a Panther through and through, Ryan, but you looked at that game and every time I watch a Raiders game, there's some of the great characters of the game today. Joey Leilua or Jordan Rapana or Junior Paulo or Josh Hodgson. I just love watching the Raiders.
Yeah, look, they were really good, weren't they? And full credit to Ricky and the medical staff down there. The two guys played that I thought it was a big risk at the start of the week. You know, would have taken a lot of focus off their I guess on their lead up, because, you know, worried about whether guys are in and out. Didn't seem to affect them at all. In fact, Hodgson was actually down with a stomach bug and, you know, played a really measured role, but his kicking game was just so crucial to the way that the game went last night. I thought the Panthers they'll be disappointed that, to get that far in the competition and not go down there and be able to compete the way that, you know, you have been, would have been disappointing. Low completion rate. They gave possession 58% to the Raiders, and defensively they missed 50 tackles. So they'll look back at that game and think that, you know, had they been at their best, I think they were a good chance of winning, but they certainly were a fair way away. And I didn't also agree with their game plan. I think when you go into a game, maybe against the Bulldogs, and you decide not to kick on the last play and get repeat sets, you could maybe understand it, because the Bulldogs don't have a lot of, you know, attacking ability. When you go up against the Raiders, one of the best attacking sides, if not the best attacking side of the competition, and you decide not to build pressure and you run it on the last play, I think it changes the mentality of, well, you know, we need to score off this set, otherwise we just hand the football over. So I'm not sure whether that was the coach's decision or he left that to the players, but I just think they got, tactically, they made a poor choice taking that mindset into the game, and they certainly weren't at their best. They had a good season, and congratulations to the boys, and I think they'll be better for the experience. But I would be, if I was one of the players, I'd be really disappointed at the way they went out last night.
One thing that Gerds, about the way the missed tackles on that, that's just what the Raiders do to you, though. They are a team that, they are first in the competition for breaking tackles. So while it is disappointing tactically, you can look back and say, well, to try and play that style of football was probably the wrong style. I still think that's probably the best way to play Canberra, to try and wear out their big men through the middle. And by making them have to work out off their line by running it on the last rather than kicking it and risking a 7-tackle, 20-metre tap, I get that. I like the fact that the Panthers actually thought a little bit alternatively, certainly against the Bulldogs the week before, and they tried to win another way rather than just this cookie-cutter style of football. And I just think that the Raiders were just right last night. I know last week that we were all umming and ahhing about Blake Austin and Hodges and whether they would play, but I think the Raiders, I don't think they, look, they certainly didn't spin a yarn because everybody else basically did all the spinning for them. Mm. But they were confident fairly early in the piece that both players would play. I spoke to Blake Austin the week before, and I said to him, because if you go back and you know blokes that have had plates put in their hands before, you can you know sort of roughly how long they can be and how quickly they can force it. And the thing is with that, the Blake Austin was very confident he was going to play last night. Everybody said he'll be back next week, this week coming now. But he was confident this would be the week he would be back, and he was. So that was – Canberra knew that. They just didn't let – they didn't tell anybody. Mm. But they didn't alternatively take anybody in a different direction either because everybody did that for them. Everybody said, well, they can't play. There's no way they'll be sick. And we spoke about it on 360 this week, and Ben Eichen said, there's no way I'd risk them. And I said, well, I would because it's a sudden-death game.
Well, you've got it, don't you, Paul?
I think you have to, Gordy.
Yeah. And I might agree with you because I was talking to Mitch Moses came in and worked at Fox on Friday night. He was saying when he played Penrith, he's never been more exhausted twice. In all the games he's played, I think he's played about 60-odd games. He goes, Penrith, when they move the ball around on your girds and they don't roll it in, they don't give you like a seven, you know, like a seven-tackle set, you know, it's actually doing it. And obviously against the Dogs at work because they scored all their points late because like we called that game and they scored probably two or three tries really late and the score blew out. So that's what made, I think, Canberra's performance last night a little bit better because the Panthers were coming home and they were starting to get on top and starting to get the momentum, but then the Raiders really dug in and it probably wasn't their best performance, but I think the Raiders do that to you. They're big, they make you miss tackles, they throw the ball around as well.
What you can't do though is I understand all that, but you got to complete, and I think that's what Penrith, they completed over 85% last week. The week before they were over 90%. So not taking away from what the Raiders produced, and they're obviously a quality side, but they don't make you drop the ball or they don't make you throw silly passes. And I think that aspect that the Panthers had been getting right, I said about 4 weeks ago, I said the Panthers are only a chance of going well in the finals if they get their ball movement and their when they pass and when they don't pass, when they get that decision-making right, if they give good sides opportunities, because defensively they're a solid side, they're not one of the best defensive sides in the competition, but if they don't get that that right when they choose to pass or not, they're going to get forced out by the better sides. And I think last night they did that. They got a couple of calls go against them early in the first half as well from the referees. I don't think they had a great game last night in Cummings. No, I'm not. But and the Raiders were really like good. But I still think the Raiders can, and they probably will have to, I think they can play better. And they were good last night, but I think they can go up another level and they'll have to do that against Melbourne.
Good on you, Gerds. And we'll speak to Blake Austin at 1:30 today, you Raiders fans. We'll speak to him at 1:30, so stick around for that. We were having a chat in there, just doing a little bit of homework before we came on air, Kenty, and we spoke about the players that, we spoke about the Raiders in the last couple of years, blokes like Tedesco and Proctor and a couple of others. They almost had these blokes, but at the end of the day, perhaps the decision was, I'm not trying to be funny here, a lot of players didn't want to move to Canberra. So then the Raiders look to the UK where they're used to the climate. They find a bloke like Hodgson or Whitehead, or they bring a bloke like Sia Soliola, and it's bloody well worked.
100%. Look, it's a funny place, Canberra. When Canberra were the mighty Raiders of the late 80s and 90s, they were a side built primarily on Queensland players, and the philosophy was quite a funny one, actually. Whenever Canberra tried to get somebody from Canterbury or Parramatta or Manly or West to come to play at Canberra, they're all like, mate, no way I'm going there. That's too cold. Mm. But when they went to see the Queenslanders and Gordon,
it's
just
the same climate up.
No. Yeah. Queenslanders didn't know the difference. Canberra, same as Manly, didn't. They had no idea of the difference in temperatures and the difference in living conditions and all that. So where the Sydney players went, no way, I'm going to Canberra, too bloody cold there. Yeah. The Queensland players didn't really know that. So that's why they got Mal Meninga, Gary Belcher, the Walders boys, Peter Jackson, Sam Bacco. They got all these great players from Queensland to come down. But then over time, obviously, Queensland have now got their own team to go to, and they've got several teams now to go to. So it's a bit harder to get the Queenslanders. Melbourne have got their system. They bring all their kids up through the Queensland system. So it's very hard to get kids from Canberra now. And Canberra had a real issue. They realised they had Tedesco and they had Proctor. Those guys actually agreed to go to the club and then backflipped. other guys just were like, Canberra got the impression that they were using them to try and just up their value with no real intention of ever going there. And in the end, Ricky Stewart just said, you know, I've had enough of this. He said, guys are using us up to up their value in the marketplace, and we're looking silly, because everybody started to basically take the piss out of the Raiders because, oh, look, no one wants to play for Ricky. Look, how bad is he going and all the rest of it. And look, they offered Anthony Milford $980,000 on the cap, and he went for less than half that to go to Brisbane. Now, work out what you think happened there.
Yeah.
But it was very difficult. It was very difficult for the Raiders to get players. So in the end, they went back to an old strategy. They said, let's find somewhere where they've got no idea or it's actually worse than what it is here.
Yeah.
So they went to England. Now, if you're living in Hull,
yeah,
and you get shown a slide of, you know, a pamphlet of Canberra, come and live here. And you look, oh, hang on, mate, 13 degrees, nice and balmy there. And that's what they did. And look, he got Hodgson, he rang Nathan Brown. Ricky rang Nathan Brown and said to him, I need a good hooker. Is there one over there? And Nathan Brown was coaching over there at the time. He said, yeah, but this one here is a real good kid.
Yeah.
And that's who he got. And no one had heard of Elliot Whitehead before he came out. And that on the back of good junior development too. The Paul Vaughans and all those guys coming through. They've been, Canberra have known they're there. They just had them sitting in the system and just waited till their time was right.
And Ricky, and I don't know where he learned it from, it's probably like a Phil Gould thing, but I know that we were chasing guys, and this is when I was playing at Brisbane, and then we lost this guy, and then I know Wayne got disappointed, and Wayne sent his development guy to go talk to him and all that. And Ricky Stewart flew up and met the kid. Yeah, I mean, it'd be pretty impressive if you're a young guy and you get a first-grade coach walking in, knocking on your door, and that's what Ricky does. So I think his recruitment's been first class. And, you know, some of those guys, there's a bit of a question mark over him, but I think that he's done a fantastic job. And, you know, I don't know, but I think their number nine is probably the favourite to get the Dally M.
Hey, this story about them not knowing what Canberra was really like, it reminds me of when I was, back in the 80s when I was in high school, they used to say, Singo was running Newtown and he brought John Rebo Dobrysiak to town from Brisbane and picked him up at the airport and took him to Vaucluse and told him he was Newtown. And
he did too. He did too.
Did he really do
he
that?
He did too, yeah. That was not the only trick Singo got out to get blokes on the books. And, but he did that. He sat down and took him there and Rebo was like, wow, what about this person? But yeah, look, that's just all part of the game. You could do that back then. There's no internet, so... Yeah, weren't we a much more innocent world back then? Mm. But that's just what you've got to do. And Canberra have done a very good job. The one thing that the Canberra have done that you see, we're starting to see around the league is they've become very clever at picking the square peg for the square hole. And when you put your roster together, coaches often have this, and I think Ricky had this early in his career, they just want the best players. And if a player comes on the market and he's got a little bit of baggage with him, but he's a great player, I'll give you an example, Todd Carney. A lot of coaches will say, mate, we've got to have him. Let's get him. We can get him cheap. Let's take him. And I think what they do is they take a risk that you can't quite get these through with these guys. So what ends up happening is it ends up backfiring on them. Whereas what's happened now is Canberra really deliberately put together a roster whereby they know who the stars are. They know that there's some players who are role players within the side. Some guys have got to do their job. And then you've got players like BJ Lalua, who just basically is, mate, you just go out and just play. You play what's in front of you, do what you've got to do. And it started to work, and I really liked the fact after the game last night, Ricky was talking about how they made some mistakes, but by the same token, that's the sort of side they are, and that's the way they play, and he's got to keep encouraging that.
Hey, Kenty, where do you get those square pegs from?
Out of your ear hole, Gordon.
Sunday Triple M NRL.
I just want to have those square pegs for the square hole.
You wouldn't know, mate. You've always been a square peg in a round hole.
Don't get cranky.
Any round hole.
The clean out of the Canterbury Bulldogs. Blake Austin. It's all coming up next, or in the course of the afternoon anyway, on Sunday Triple M NRL, the Viking Clap. And welcome back to Sunday Triple M NRL. Gordy Tallis, Ryan Girdler, Paul Ken, Anthony Maroon. Our number is 133353. Yeah, Blake Austin coming up shortly. We'll talk about the clean out at the Canterbury Bulldogs. I was reading your article yesterday, Paul Kent, in the telly, which we all read on Saturday because we just love what you write, old mate. And I like this particularly being an old Sydney boy. All the character names that get a mention in this article about Eddie Hayson and the match fixing, et cetera, names like George Freeman and Lenny McPherson, even Robert Askin got a start. And then I just get almost to the end of the article and I see the name Antonio Torres, which was a name I am not familiar with, in association with somebody that Eddie Haasen blamed. Can you fill us in on this character, Antonio Torres?
Oh, well, obviously, look, we're all aware at the moment that the match-fixing allegation or investigation is on. The New South Wales Police have formed a strike force to investigate what happened there. And Eddie is quite adamant that he didn't not only fix the game, he didn't even bet on the games that police were investigating. So he called a press conference during the week and said, look, this is I'm here to basically answer any question you guys ask. And what I found interesting about the nature of the questions was many of them were quite accusatory in nature. Secondly, there was almost a naivety about the way gambling works. And so at one point they focused on the fact that in 2006, Eddie had bet on the Warriors at 16.5 start to basically get the win by the spread over Newcastle when he learned that Andrew Johns was out injured. So I went back and I had a look at the games, I didn't watch the games. I looked at the form around the games. Now the season, that game that was the Warriors Newcastle game was round 4 in 2006. Newcastle won their first 3 games. The season before, the Knights played obviously 24 games. Andrew Johns played 16 of those 24 games. And of the 16 he played, they won 8, they lost 8. So the win percentage is about 50%. Without Andrew Johns in the other 8 games, they lost all 8. So their win percentage went from 50% with Andrew Johns in the side to 0 with Andrew Johns out of the side. So in 2006, they won their first 3 games with Andrew Johns in the side. Then he hurts his neck Thursday night at training and he's out of the game. And Eddie got mail that this was the case and bet on New Zealand to cover the spread. Now, if Eddie Haasen knew that and did not make the bet as a professional gambler, he's a moron. Anybody that has a bet, you're always looking for the edge. If you got information that a guy who has a dramatic effect over one team's win or loss percentages is not playing, you take advantage of that. Yet people were asking Eddie Haasen about that as if he had done something wrong himself. Now, if you go to the races, and all these people out there will know this, every time you go to the races, people always say to someone who knows a little bit more about racing than they do, have you got a tip? And now, that tip is essentially, do you know something about a horse that should have it winning today? That's all Eddie Haasen knew. Yet people were asking him the question the other day as if he'd done something wrong. He didn't pay Andrew Johns to not play. He didn't have any part of that. He just got information earlier than the bookies that Andrew Johns was out of the game, and therefore, because the bookies had yet to adjust their price, he backed it when it was still a market set for Andrew Johns in the game. And I just think it's a no-brainer. And so then you get to the issue out of that, which is what's on now about this match fixing and why the police are fixing a game that this guy, who publicly this week put himself on record that he has not had, not only fixed, he did not had no part in fixing those games, but didn't even bet on those games. So why would he do that? Why would the police be investigating? And everybody's saying, well, what? And this is the other nature of my industry, which is journalism, that people say, well, why would the police be investigating if there's nothing to investigate? And my explanation, which I offered, is that Antonio Torres, who was a bikie called who was called Fat Tony by all his friends, which is hardly imaginative, but he was within the gang, and there was concerns within the bikie gang that he was not Reggie Didge and that he was actually informing. He'd come out of jail before where he received a much lighter penalty than the people who were with him, even though he was the actual mastermind of the drug deal. And that tipped off the bikies that perhaps he wasn't quite square as far as they saw it. So they kept an eye on him, and then they got information that he was actually informing to the Crime Commission. So what ended up happening is, he was setting up some guys. He was trying to get a deal done from within the bike organisation. And when they were looking at doing it, they were told, look, cut off. This guy's out on the weekend. Once we're going to have a party, he's going to be told, mate, you're no longer part of us and you're out of here. So what ended up happening then was, and this is the nature of human nature really, is these guys knew that he was on the way out. So they thought, well, once he's out, he can't come back at us and say, give me my money. So before he was out, they went up and they snipped him. They basically said, mate, there's a game on this weekend. It's fixed. we're going to all back it. Give us your money and we'll put it on for you. So he did that. He gave them money. That weekend he got kicked out. He can't come back and say, well, where's my money? Because he's, the law of the bike is once you're out, you don't have a right to ask for your money back. Yeah. And so that he's, the other bikies knew that. So they basically robbed him because they knew he was on the way out. But he then went to the Crime Commission where he didn't know that they knew he was an informant, and he's told the Crime Commission that the game was fixed. So the Crime Commission's looked at that. Now, where this starts to hold a little bit of water is that the people have, the investigators have looked at the games and can't find any money trail. Now, when Ryan Tandy was caught back in 2010, there was a clear money trail. There was clearly an over bloated amount of money put on this one result in the game, which was the first points to come from a penalty kick.
An exotic.
And you could quite clearly see that. And then there was all sorts of, the police had all these phone records of who'd rang who. And it was quite interesting. They color-coded it according to who Ryan Tandy rang. And then they would color the people blue or red or yellow, depending on whether they then bet on the game themselves or bet on the result themselves. And in the end, only Ryan Tandy was found guilty. But in this instance, the police have found no record of it. So it leads to two theories. One is either that the money was put at an overseas account, betting account, somewhere in the West Indies or something's got mentioned. Or secondly, it was put through an Australian bookmaker, but not put through the books, which is illegal. And the bookmaker would lose their license if that happened. Okay, but why would they do that? Because then they wouldn't pay the tax on the turnover tax that they would need to pay. So this is why it's hard for the police to get this up. And as Eddie Hayson said on Thursday, if I supposedly put $1 million on this bet, on this game, to fix the result, as everybody alleged, and there's been two amounts alleged, $700,000 and $1 million. He said, how come no one can find that money? Yet when he put $18,000 on a Manly Parramatta game earlier in the year, they can find that. They can quite clearly find that $18,000. And then it was actually asked of him, well, didn't you win that $18,000 on that game? Well, sorry, you put $18,000 on. You backed Parramatta to cover the spread, I think it was. Then out of that, they went and put the money, the winnings on a horse. And he's asked, well, what did you know? And he said, well, that's just the nature of gambling. You take money that you've won here and you put it on something else the next time. And that's old school gambling, is to try and turn a small amount into a big amount by basically riding your luck. And so it's interesting. I can't see how, I actually don't think anything will come of the match fixing.
What about, okay, that's what I was going to ask you. You don't think we'll hear any more about it?
No, we'll hear plenty more about it. We will hear plenty, but I think it'll take 12 months before we get to the end of it. But I actually don't think the police will come up with any type of conviction because there's no money trail.
Paul, I watch you on 360 a lot, but how does the game try to stop this? And I heard you say that they need tighter laws on who they go and address them, because you said that sometimes coaches or players will be there and they don't actually know people that are in the dress room. Yeah, do you think that's got to be tighter?
100% good. Look, part of the problem for the NRL is it's not that whether there's corruption, it's just the perception there's corruption that's damaging. You don't even have to have a match fix. All this is damaging. And if they get to the end of the investigation in 12 months' time and find there's nothing there, it still damaged the game. So what they've got to do is they've got to put tighter controls around what they do. And Ray Murray, after this emerged earlier in the year, Manly went out and Manly got Ray Murray. He is the former steward of Racing New South Wales and regarded as the best steward in the world, and has a long history of training stewards under him who are picked up in Singapore and Hong Kong and everybody else to go and run the racing over there because they do such a good job. So Ray Murray went in and he looked at Manly and he found some areas where, I'll explain this carefully, but Manly did exactly as they were required by the NRL standards. So Manly had done nothing wrong. But second to that, he found that there was ways that not just essentially that the NRL standards could be improved. And that would be things by having more CCTV around dressing rooms so you can actually record who goes in and out of dressing rooms, having tighter controls about who can go in. Once the players get in the dressing room, they have to surrender their mobile phones. Now, people think that might be draconian, but when jockeys go to the track, they have to surrender their mobile phones. They are not allowed to sit in the jockey's room because they might hear that they might see a jockey over in the corner who's dehydrated to try and make weight, who's really struggling to stand up, and he's about to get out on the horse. And if they text a friend saying, this guy can hardly stand up, let alone ride, then you've got the perception that something underhanded is going on. And rugby, we've seen players this year go off the field injured And when we go to the dressing room camera, they're on their mobile phone. Now, that is a poor look for the game. The NRL just has to come in and put in tighter controls. Why they don't get Ray Murray here in to come in and oversee this. The other part, too, is the Andrew Johns example, is we are not told, Gordon, at the moment, when an injury occurs, there is no requirement from the team to actually announce that injury. So Andrew Johns was picked in the team on Tuesday. He injured himself Thursday. And the club was not required to tell anybody he was injured until an hour before kickoff. Now, because betting was suspended because of the weight of money, because word had gone around in the rugby league whispers that he was out, word eventually did get out. But how often do we see young players put in sides, but they're protected, so nobody knows they're in the side until an hour before kickoff when suddenly they're announced, or we see someone's injured. We found out only, we got confirmation on Friday that Austin and Hodges were playing.
But that was only because Ricky wanted us to know. Well, he could have kept that until Saturday as well.
He could have kept that until Saturday, and to his credit, he named them on the team Tuesday. He came out again, and every day he said, look, I'm expecting them to play. We didn't believe him.
Yeah.
But and then on Friday he came out and he confirmed it. But the fact is the NRL needs to have practices in place where you just, the moment there's an injury that is ruling you out of the game, even if there's the fear that you might not play, they have to announce it. There's so much more we can be doing in this area.
Mate, you've just given me a fantastic idea, Kenty. A fantastic idea. When you come to Maroons Trivia Night, surrender your mobile phone. It's just killing well trivia. Done. Just killing
is
trivia.
It?
Yes, killing it. Sunday Triple M NRL is thanks to Bryden's Lawyers. Google, tweeting, texting. Canterbury Bulldogs, a big clean out. We're going to talk about that next with Ryan Girdler, Paul Kent and Gordy Tallis right here on Sunday Triple M NRL as we rock the finals. And welcome back to it. After a weekend of rugby league finals, we say goodbye now to the Broncos. We say goodbye to the Panthers. We are talking rugby league. Our number is 133353. Sunday telly today, David Riccio writes an interesting article called Cleaning Out the Doghouse, Ryan, and suggestions that the board at the Canterbury Footy Club have spoken with Des about how to make things better in the coming years, who they need to keep, who they need to get rid of, some of the issues that surround all those things. And I have to say that, over the course of a footy season, I do I'm just saying this because I do. I'm not asking you blokes to bag me or anything, but I do a lot of corporate things where there are people there involved in the rugby league and often from the Dogs. And I think there's a bit of an issue in the club with this whole thing about Hopper Wadi not playing on Sunday. I think a lot of supporters don't like it. A lot of people within the club don't like it. Perhaps some of the players think that maybe he's getting preferential treatment. And I've got nothing but respect for everyone's religion, Ryan. But I think in this day and age, to not play footy because it's on Sunday, that's a lot to ask. That's just one of the things, though.
You feel that there's a problem within the club, like within the playing group or within some of the administration?
I think the whole the playing group, the coach, the administration, the supporters.
Yeah,
it's a lot to ask, mate. If they made the grand final, does this bloke not play or does he come back and play? And I'm not disrespecting his religion.
Sure. Yeah. Look, I think he. Well, look, essentially they were knocked out on a Sunday, weren't they? And we saw Brett Morris get moved in at the last moment to play fullback. So certainly that would have been hard for the fans to take. The players came out publicly and said that they were okay with it. Des obviously knew about it at the start of the season at the start of the negotiations. It's a strange one. It's hard for me to understand because I'm not a religious guy, but if that's your belief and you stick to it, and he did, I think that was the big question. I would have had, I guess, less respect had they decided to play him after standing him down or after choosing not to play through the season. The fact that they held firm during a knockout semi-final, I think, showed the fact that obviously it's an important decision that they've made, and they made it together. Look, I guess for the Bulldogs, we're just used to, you know, those guys being at the pointy end of the season and involved at this time of year. And for me, the concern would be the style in which they've played the last couple of years. I think they got around this, to around the second week of the semis or the first week of the semis last year as well. I haven't seen a lot of growth or improvement in the way that they do things. Mm. And I think that the game's sort of moving past the way that they play, to be honest. And that's what I'd be looking at. I know they're going to make some changes within the coaching ranks, obviously underneath Dez there, for bring some new ideas in. But essentially, it's up to Dez, isn't it? And Dez has always been at the forefront of the technology aspect of the game. But whether or not he's going to look at changing the way that they play, or whether he still thinks that the way that they play is working for their team and the dynamics of their team, which is obviously, you know, they haven't got whether Moses Mbai is a halfback that can take control and manage a team, or whether or not he chooses to play through the forwards, having his halves get the football too wide, is just something that they'll have to go through in the off season. But I personally think it's time that they had a look at playing a different style of football, and if they want to be successful in the next couple of years, I think the game essentially has moved past the way that they attack.
Is that Desi's job, or do you think, Kenty, they will bring somebody new in? Because sometimes, you know, when you need, like, Desi's been around a while, and I think the way he played at Manly was really successful. Glenn Stewart had the range to overcall any half, and he was probably one of the best ball-playing locks that we've seen, and I think he tried to take that style to the Dogs. Do you think Desi can reinvent himself and play a totally different style?
Oh, look, I don't know how much they really need to, which is probably going to disappoint you blokes and might disappoint a few Bulldogs fans. I think it's worthwhile. If you look at the Bulldogs this year, after round 20, they were second in completion rates. They're also second in tries scored, which not a lot of people actually realise.
Wow.
When they dropped off after round 20, they went back to 15th in completion rates. And once they went back to their, from round 20 to 26, they were 15th in the NRL. So that's when their try scoring suddenly dried up. So if you're Dez, and as you said, Gerge, he does like his stats, but that's a pretty clear line, isn't it? Second in completions,
yep.
Second in try scoring. We go down to 15th in completions for the last six games.
Yep.
And we can't score a point. And that, so Dez always preaches the value of actually getting through the completions and doing those sorts of things. And we all sort of sit there and think, well, it's a bit of a cop-out. It's an easy way to really just explain the lack of defense, of attack. But it really just adds up. So, yeah, I think that's... Now, yeah, are they deeper issues in that? Yeah, you can find them. I think they lost confidence in their attack. I think it began when they lost confidence in their kicking game, their fifth tackle options. And because of that, that's when they started to run the ball a little bit more. And they started to lose their confidence because... As you start to get towards that fifth tackle, the jitters, they start coming around tackle three, because we better start doing something here, because we're not going to be able to do anything with our kicks. We need to start working on something. But I just think, you know, you want to look at, there's talk in the paper today that Moses Mbai will go to hooker next year,
yeah,
and that Lucian is now on the way out. I think that's a solid move.
I don't think there's enough creativity around the dummy half, to be honest. I think Lucian's a solid player, but I think he'll suit a club that has, like say, a West Tigers, where they just need someone to get in there and give the ball. But if you've got
But they've
halves,
already got Matt Ballon there.
Don't forget,
and he'll play exactly that role.
Yeah, exactly right. So, yeah, I think they need someone in there that possibly can create a little bit more through that area.
And Mbai will do that. Mbai, you give him the idea, mate, you run. Yep. You see it. And, yeah, one of the great conversations you have about dummy half players is Danny Bedaris and how he used to play. And he just had this attitude. The minute he saw anything loose around the play of the ball, he was just out and he was going. And it was then everybody else's job in the team to go with him.
Yeah.
And to catch up with him and play off him. And if you gave Mbai a similar role.
Yeah,
and just said to him, mate, this is your job. You just shovel the ball on, bring the forwards onto it, and then when you see something, just go and we'll get with you. And
would it be him or Reynolds? Would you put him or Reynolds?
Talk is Mbai. So,
wow.
But I think Reynolds can stay where he's at. I don't know whether physically he's probably big enough to handle the tackling in a dummy half.
Well, he's got to be bigger than Mbai, hadn't he?
No.
He looks bigger than him.
Does he?
Yes.
I think Michael Ennis also had played a massive part of the Bulldogs and the way, obviously, that they used to play, and his decision making there at dummy half. I think it comes down to, you know, his pass selection and his ability to run, and he's a really crafty, and I think we've seen it the last couple of years with the Sharks as well. He's a really crafty dummy half, and when they're at their best, the Bulldogs, I think he was there and doing a pretty good job.
Okay, 133353. Adrian is on the line. I think he's a Bulldog supporter. Adrian, that's right. You're a Doggies man.
Look, I am. Look, the club's in crisis, to be honest. It all falls back on Dez. I mean, you go right through it. Moses Mbai, I tell you what he is. He's not a hooker. He's not a half. He's an outside back. He's either a setter or a fullback. Mm. I'd more go with Josh Reynolds in the nine. Michael Leisha was one of the upcoming. You look at Mike Mick Ennis as well. I mean, Desi is the number nine, is what Kryptonite is, a Superman. I mean, Ennis goes to Cronulla. No, but sorry. I got Dez out of the wrong. I was so excited when he came over, but he's got to reinvent himself. Noel Clare got the sack because if you fail 5 years in a row, how do you expect to keep your position? Recruitment's been atrocious. I mean, they signed this Jared McAnally, who looked like a promising guy from the Queensland Cup, centre or winger. Never been given a go at first grade. I don't know if he's any good or not, but obviously they don't think he is. Hasn't played one game of first grade in 2 or 3 years. And Aidan Tolman, he's the worst prop I've seen play 50 games, then 100 games. It'll soon be 200 games.
I think you'd be a bit hard. I actually think Aidan Tolman's
hard on Tolman.
I think he's a great player. But
that's a bit extreme, though, isn't it, Adrian, to say the club's in crisis?
I do. I could name 35 props better than Aidan Tolman. Matt Pryor is just another one.
All right, well, mate, thanks so much for your call. Mm. Keep them coming. Love your passion. This is Sunday Triple M NRL, and we're doing it all thanks to Bryden's Lawyers, protecting your future. Sure, obviously no game this afternoon because we have had our two finals for this week. And, of course, the winners coming out of the week was the Cowboys over the Broncos. And then, of course, yesterday, Canberra beat the Raiders. And that's all thanks to Tyre Power. Go and see Tyre Power. They've got a great range of Kumho tyres. And Kumho tyres, as you know, are wonderful tyres. Now, guys, I know Gordy, Ryan and Paul Kent, I know you guys don't want to spend too much time on this because it's not really, in a true sense, rugby league related, but we're hearing reports out of Brisbane yesterday and then today, and of course in press conferences, that Wayne Bennett has parted from his wife for 42 years, a lovely lady by the name of Trish. They're 42 years, as I say, they've got children together. Wayne has now found someone new in his life, somebody who apparently he met during his stint at the Newcastle Knights, and that lady has now followed him to Brisbane. But as I say, we don't want to spend too much time on this. Gordy, you're on the ground in Brisbane. You live there. Anything you want to report?
Oh, no. Well, obviously, it was a bit of a shock to everybody. Obviously, Wayne has been a father figure in a lot of our lives. And, it's his private life. And, you know, you've got to respect that. That's what he said. And, you know, Trish has been fantastic. And out of respect for the kids, you know, I know Elizabeth and Catherine really good and young Justin. I think your thoughts go out to those guys, you know. And as I said, it's a private life and, you know, it happens. And so sad, it's just a part of life these days, isn't it? You know, people get divorced. It's sort of shock to see someone like that. But, you know, I think he addressed the players. I think that's something that I read. I think he addressed them, you know, 24 hours before he played. So I don't think it's going to affect his coaching. I don't think it's going to, you know, affect the way the players think of him. But I suppose, you know, just the public, I suppose, those people over 40 might look at Wayne a little bit different, but they don't play footy with him.
Okay.
Yeah, I just think it's very sad. It doesn't really have a lot to do with football and the, you know, it's, I suppose it's out there on the fringes of this soap opera of rugby league. Certainly a shock to everybody. But the season's now over for the Broncos, so I think essentially, that's where the story ends.
Okay, Sunday Triple M NRL. Next, we're going to talk about the Sharks-Cowboys game next weekend. I'm hearing reports that if the Sharks win that game, they'll immediately close off the Captain Cook Bridge and the Tom Uglies Bridge, and the Shire will party one whole week at Northies, Miranda Hotel, all those great pubs you've got.
How good's Northies?
Billy Harrigan will put on a karaoke day in one of the bigger parks down there. It'll be absolute fun festival. So Raiders Storm next
It'll
week.
Be a one-man band if Billy's putting on a party.
No one else will get a sing if it's karaoke. Sharks, Cowboys, Storm, Canberra. We're going to talk about those two games next for Bryden's as Triple M rocks the footy.